Okay, hello everyone. Welcome to our December 11th, 2006 meeting of the City Council. Let the record show that all council members are present. And we'll begin the meeting with a moment of silence. Thank you. We have some special guests tonight and some special artwork tonight that's lining the walls. I'm sure you're all enjoying it. And so we asked some of our artists to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance. So Edith is going to be the spokesperson, but I ask all of you to say it with us, okay? You start us, Edith.
Ready, begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible,
with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. We have a number of special announcements and things, but we also have some special presentations, and our artists are the first ones, so I think we're going to go with that right off the bat. So who is going to be talking about the artwork and the project here? Do we have a spokesperson? And do you want the whole council down there? Do you want us down there for presentation, or what would you like?
Sure, that'd be great.
Okay, let's all go down.
I'm Susie Correa, and I am one of the co-chairs on the Estero Bay Youth Coalition, representing with the Sheriff's Department. And my co-chair, Marianne Britton, is also in the front row. We have lots of adults and young people that are part of our Estero Bay Youth Coalition, and Drug and Alcohol Services joined us in promoting this poster contest for the No Smoking on the Beaches in Morro Bay. And as you can see, this is the result of our poster contest. We have our winners posted over here, and we would like to present the awards. We have first award, Braden Correa. This is my little boy. He's in kindergarten and he's at Del Mar Elementary. Braden, go ahead and point to yours. Yes. You got best kindergarten poster, the kindergarten category. Next one is Julia Franzman. Is Julia here? This is for the first grade poster winner. Axel McClear. And Axel attends Del Mar Elementary. He's in second grade. Good job, Axel. Third grade, excuse me. It's close. Nico Jaroslawski. Nico is in second grade at Del Mar Elementary. And he's a grand prize winner in the category K through 3. Nico, would I to also present to you a $25 check from Drug and Alcohol Services Friday Night Live program for $25. Lily Keough. She here? She is a winner in the fourth grade level at Del Mar Elementary. Michael Mitchell. Sure. Come on up. And you're the fifth grade Del Mar Elementary winner. Monarch Grove. Sorry, Monarch Grove. Just get all these schools straight. Oh, Lily Keo. And this one I know. She's at Baywood Elementary. She's also one of my current DARE students who's graduating from DARE on Wednesday. And this is Edith Cordova, sixth grader at Baywood Elementary. Edith also was, she's a sixth grade winner for that grade level, and she's also an overall winner for fourth through sixth. And you also get a $25 check from San Luis Obispo County Friday Night Live program. Go point out your poster. Beautiful poster. Brady Tibbetts. There he is. Brady goes to Los Osos Middle School, and he entered the seventh grade level. Seventh, eighth grade level, and he gets also an overall winner, $25 check from San Luis Obispo County Friday Night Live program. Good job. We also have Annie Cumming. She's here. Annie's an eighth grader at Los Osos Middle School and won the eighth grade category. Good job. Sarah Stanger. Sarah Stanger is 12th grader at Morro Bay High School, and she entered the 12th grade level, obviously, and she also got the overall 10th through 12th grade category. And she's also receiving a $25 check from San Luis Obispo County Friday Night Live Drug and Alcohol Services. Good job. And the winning posters will be laminated and put in various areas throughout the city, illustrating our no smoking on the beaches. Good job.
Good job.
Let's give everybody a round of applause that entered the poster contest that are here.
Thank you, all you young artists. That's wonderful. And please, at the break, everyone, enjoy looking at the artwork. I was part of the lucky few who got to judge these, and they are just incredible. They're really well done. Okay, we have another special presentation. So may I have Joe and Carmen Rudolph please come forward? Turn around, face the audience. Some of you who are very young or not so young anymore may remember these two, although without their Santa hats, maybe not as clearly. I'll wait till the Exodus happens, I think. Okay. The Rudolphs arrived here in 1994. Joe joined the neighborhood watch, and he used to borrow the Santa suit from Warren Dorn to ride the trolley with the caroling cops. Eventually, he saw a couple of Santa suits on sale at Rite Aid, and he bought them both, one for the caroling cops and one for himself. The first year that they decided to do Santa at their home, he set out a cardboard fireplace and a chair and Joe became Santa, dispensing candy canes and leftover toys from the caroling cops. Next year, they stocked up on toys with donations from Morro Bay merchants, and Santa Joe and Mrs. Claus have gave out over 850 toys. By their final year, 2004, they had given away over 35,000 toys to children in our community. After 11 years, Santa and Mrs. Claus decided to retire. It wasn't just the couple of weeks at Christmas when thousands of visitors went through the elaborately decorated home, but the preparation would start in July and the cleanup would end in March. And I lost the rest of my speech here, so I lost the final thing, but you had told me how much it was worth all the donations and everything that you got from the community. Do you remember that?
I don't know that you put it.
No, I don't think we ever put a
price on
okay.
it.
But
the last toy order was $4,500.
Okay, right. I mean, it just their generosity here and the generosity of the community has been incredible.
Yes.
What happened was my printer didn't print the whole thing that I wrote. I'm sorry. but it got the essence.
Had it not been for the people that supported us here and for all of our elves and everything, we could never have done this.
And they did this in their home. They'd have six different decorated trees. Six. More than six?
Add 30 to that.
36 trees. I had that wrong from the beginning. 36
decorated
trees.
22,000 lights.
Wow.
And an electric bill that went like this.
All for the joy of the kids in this community. Anyway.
And the adults.
I would just like to give some recognition.
Let me give you this first, and then you can talk, okay? Because I was going to ask you to say a few words anyway. Okay, so what we've done is we have named Joe and Carmen Rudolph Community Treasures for extraordinary dedication to our community and the city of Morro Bay, December 2006. And this one's special. It's got Santa on it.
Oh.
Thank you. So,
okay.
Please take the microphone and say a few words.
This all could never have been possible if it hadn't have been for the merchants in the city of Morro Bay. When we first started, there was never any doubts. Everybody gave freely. In fact, we even had some people gave us a little guff because we forgot to ask them for donations for toys. And if we were mad at them, which it wasn't. And also that there's other people that were behind the scenes that helped us. Hayes Printing made up all my flyers and all the off awards and things that we gave away. Goofy Graphics made up our sign that we were able to display all of our people that donated to us. So I'd just like to thank them and all the elves that helped us and everybody that was behind the scenes, because we could have never done it without any help. And just like to thank you. And you want to say something?
No, you said it all.
I know what the information was. It was all about the new families that they've found and that they're going to be Santa and Mrs. Claus for their grandchildren from now on. That's how I was going to conclude. So, so have a wonderful holiday. Okay, now, other announcements and presentations. I was asked to let people know that beginning January 1st, 2007, cover it or it will cost you $10. When you take anything to the Coal Canyon landfill from now on, starting January 1st, if it doesn't have a cover over it, you're going to be charged $10. So that's a little reminder to everyone for that. And Hank, are you going to talk about caroling cops? Okay. Well, I can or you can. I just didn't. Okay. Listen for the caroling cop cars. They're going to be out tomorrow and Wednesday and Thursday. Tomorrow's North Morro Bay. right? And then Central on Wednesday and South Morro Bay on Thursday. And you'll see Santa Claus, and he'll be giving away some wonderful stuffed toys. So everybody watch for him. It's a wonderful part of our holiday activities in Morro Bay. The other thing I wanted to say is that due to the holidays, etc., I will not be having office hours until January. And step right up to the podium, and you may begin.
Good evening, Mayor and Council. My name is Keith Taylor, resident of Morro Bay, friends of the Morro Bay Fire Department. First of all, I want to wish all of you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. I would like to urge the Council to really get behind building the fire station, as two-thirds of us, or 65% of the people in this community, voted for Measure Q, and the number one priority on the agenda was building the fire department. So I would like to see you get behind and support it, and ask Mr. Hendricks, our city manager, a vehicle to fund it. I know we have the property on the north end that Rob Schultz, our city attorney, is working on to subdivide so we can put it up for sale. But Measure Q gives us a vehicle to take a loan out to build this. And I would like to see, and our community would like to see, all of you support this and get behind it. So when the new year comes around and we get out to the budget, I'm hoping that all of you will get behind this and take that money from Measure Q, a good amount of it, to finance this fire station that we really do need. On another note, the Friends of the Morro Bay Fire Department has put a rosemary tree in City Hall. So it really smells good, and if you want to go around and see it and smell it, and there's also applications for Friends of the Morro Bay Fire Department there. And thank you again.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Ginger Hendricks. I live 2575 Hemlock, and I wanted to come sort of greet the new council and give some thoughts if I could. First, congratulations to Betty Winholz and Mayor Peters for receiving a winning welcome back to the council, and to Councilman Baxley for his appointment. My hope is that this council for 2007 will take a fresh and energetic approach to watching out for the citizens of Morro Bay. As Mr. Baxley said, as he was sworn in, we'd love it if you could look toward the future of our town.
I think you mean Mr. Grantham?
Excuse me, yes, Mr. Grantham. As an individual citizen of this town, this is what I mean. I cannot walk into the office of a developer who is interested in building a home to sell, or maybe even an entire subdivision to sell, and say to him, please be concerned for the citizens of Morro Bay while you pursue your project, and ask that you would change the primary question you use to make the decisions for our town. Please ask the question, what is best for the people we represent? I think that the demographic of our town holds the answer to that question. We need housing that we can afford, air that's good to breathe, water that's safe to drink, a town center that is thriving, streets that are safe, services for seniors, common areas for us to do the work of uniting a little town that is made up of so diverse a population, senior citizens and young families, and lots of working people, and long-term part-time residents, and lots of visitors. I don't have the power to make change in this way, but you do. You can watch out for us. You can look ahead for us. Please make a difference. We're counting on you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello. My name is Dawn Fuhrberg, homeowner of Morro Bay off of Seaview Avenue. And I'm here representing many families, children of Morro Bay. And what I'd like to say to you is that you have put our children's health and lives in jeopardy. And that's why I'm here today. Both of my children were sick with stomach problems just prior to the public announcement of the water crisis. My 10-month-old daughter here was throwing up, and my 4.5-year-old daughter had tummy aches after drinking the water. This, for me, leaves no, there's little doubt for me that there is a connection between my children's tummy problems and the high nitrate levels. Why do I believe this? Because I had to do my own research on high nitrate levels. And what I discovered was that high nitrate levels and other contaminants go hand in hand. I have the brochures here and studies that were done by Cornell University that I looked up on the website, on the web, to find out these answers. The residents needed this info along with a lot of the answers to many of the questions that were published in the last Bay News article. There should have been a bilingual flyer that went door to door offering websites and other information to its residents. The city of Morro Bay says this crisis only lasted 36 hours. I beg to differ. The crisis did not start the day the public announcement was made. It started back on November 8th, when the high nitrate levels were rising for an unknown period of time. And as of last week, the city of Morro Bay was still pumping the Morro wells and mixing it with state water to see if the MTB... You are my city council, and I'm holding you accountable. You are legally bound and responsible for the health and safety of our citizens. And I demand a full report, along with all my friends and families, and a full public disclosure of what happened during that water crisis. When the city manager, Bill Hendricks, gets up here today to give his report and downplays the water crisis and says it only lasted 36 hours and that there is no way to get flyers out, which I can think of a half a dozen ways to go door to door and get flyers to every single resident in this community. I ask you to hold him accountable. Aren't you running the city? And shouldn't you be telling him what to do? And shouldn't you be asking him answers? Please do this, and please represent our citizens and our children. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. We discourage applause because we also discourage boos. So please, if you are in agreement with what's being said, you may wave your hand. It's very effective. We see that and we know. Thank you.
Hello there. I'm Matthew Fleming. I'm a Morro Bay resident, and I'm also chair of the Surfrider Foundation for the county. And I've been in front of this council before and many others talking about water quality, particularly in regards to our ocean and swimming and getting sick and so on. I didn't think I would be up here in a different capacity, and that is to talk about, as a citizen of Morro Bay, the water that we drink and the potential for that water to make us sick, and maybe as sick as some of the runoff that we get from the streams in the wintertime in the ocean. I am particularly upset about the way things were handled after the fact. There's always the potential for something to go wrong and fingers to be pointed and things to be handled incorrectly. But once some problem has occurred, it's how the people who are responsible conduct themselves in dealing with that problem and addressing it and taking responsibility that matters. And that's where I see a shortfall in regards to the high nitrate level problem that we had in the last few weeks. I also want to point out that this is not an issue of ephemeral kinds of contaminants that we may or may not be thinking are in the air or in the ocean and leave. And of course, I know the reasons why. It's because these children need to go home and get ready for bed, trim trees, do many of the things that the other children here tonight should be doing, but instead they're here policing their own water quality. And it's an absurd position for children and parents to be in who have far better things to do with their time. So I just believe that if we are talking about on that big poster as we come into Morro Bay that we need to get in touch with our better nature, I think it needs to start with the nature of our water. And before we let tourism and any other thing come before water that we drink, we need to make sure this doesn't happen again, and we figure out what really happened, who was accountable, and have them explain to us how it won't happen again. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name's Phil Hill. I'm a Morro Bay citizen. My address is Boat on Bay, and I'm not here about the nitrate thing. I agree with these folks that we should be heads up on things like that. The reason I'm here is several months ago I came here in my skipping record routine about the boatyard, and I got some really good news from Councilman Bill Pierce. He informed me that the city had, in fact, mailed a letter to the other people about fixing the falling apart dock and the Martoni triangle obstruction that keeps the boatyard from functioning like it should. And he informed me that the city had, in fact, sent a letter that was pretty specific about the actions that needed to be taken, otherwise the city was going to sue them. As I recall, that's what he said. I was really happy to hear that. I waited a couple of months. I went by City Hall, asked to see the city attorney, see if I could get an update for the owner of the place. And I was told that he was busy, and he understand that, you know. So I left my number and the question and that, and I never got a return call. I was very unhappy about that. It would have only taken a minute or two, and I never got a return call. So what I'm here today doing is rubbing a little egg in face, hopefully, that as a citizen here, I expect to get these responses of some sort that are at least, you know, polite and not too overly evasive. But the other thing is I would like to get an update on that because I am on a waiting list to get my boat out of the water and the boats that need fare. So I'm hoping to get some good news from you guys. And I know you got a lot of stuff going on. Congratulations to the incoming. Thank you to the outgoing. And Janice, every time I hear a shotgun in the morning, I think of you. Thanks for not standing up and carrying out on your promise to the city.
Okay.
Madam Mayor, can I interrupt for just a second? Mr. Hill, I have to confess I don't remember our conversation. However, let me say that any negotiations the city is having, to the best of my knowledge, with the folks you referred to have nothing whatsoever to do with the boatyard or their swinging boats over or that situation entirely. I'm sorry, you must have misunderstood me, because I have not, nor would I. That has nothing to do with our negotiations with those folks.
Okay.
Well, okay, and that would be fine. And if you want to take that, bring it to the city attorney, please.
Okay. Dorothy.
My name is Dorothy Cutter. Okay, this is in reference to the item you have on the agenda on the moratorium on Main Street. Okay. First, I read the staff report. I do not see any urgency in that area. What I do see is tremendous urgency in the whole city. So if you want to have a moratorium on what's happening, you have to put it on the whole city. Okay, there's a big urgency in the city because small houses are being torn down at an unprecedented rate, and very large houses are going up on very small lots and impacting neighborhood. Now, the area that you're talking about in the moratorium, this was rezoned in 1984. I think I've sent you the history of the zoning in that whole area from the beginning, and we're all very happy with the current zoning. I don't know how you can get more restrictive than R1PD between Acacia Street and the fuel dock. And so you need to deny any variances or exceptions in that area. You need to apply PD overlay in the way it was originally intended, to be very restrictive, not to help bottom line of developers and give them extra benefits. Now, if your intention is to allow more development or change the zoning to visitor-serving commercial, this would be fought against the people who live in this part of town. And I'm very concerned that this is where you might be a moratorium on this small area, because, you know, dealing with a small area is considered very poor planning. Okay, then. And you have to remember that Main Street down there between Acacia and the State Park is only 50 feet wide. It's only dedicated 50 feet. That's a residential zone. Because anybody here who wants to talk about this, they know they have to talk about it now during the public comment period. And let's see. I guess that's all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Mayor and council members, my name is Bernadette Pekarik. I'm relatively a newcomer in this area. I've only been here since 1956. I'm not sure where this emergency moratorium is coming from. there hasn't been a home built in the area for a long time. There's already a specific plan in this area known as Mixed Use Area B, which is very restrictive. So why waste city money when it could be spent on a city-owned dog park where we could put this dog to rest once and for all? The last thing we want to see in this area are hotels and motels under visitor serving in a predominantly residential neighborhood. I feel this ordinance could be a Trojan horse for this purpose, and that may be what is driving this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Bill Martini. I live on Main Street in that area, and another time, I know I've never got into the mix as far as talking about Phil Hill and his comments. The boatyard, I didn't come here tonight to talk about it. I could go into it in great detail. We've always stayed on the sidelines on why it came up originally. The threats that he made against my wife, threatened to get her, threatened us with violence, threatened to sue us, turn our life upside down. We sat on the sidelines. This was not an issue about running a boatyard. This is about a renter that claimed he was grandfathered in on our property. Which else in that flag? We have not shut down the boatyard. The boatyard is operating. It's operating at probably twice the speed of when Danny Milligan ran it. That's the same person that Mr. Pierce told me threatened him twice with a gun. But we offered to rent that boatyard to Danny just to keep the boatyard in business. And then Joe came along and threatened us, and we won't rent to a person like that. So it doesn't have to do with the boatyard. It has to do with the renter. And I refuse to have my wife threatened by that man. So that aside, I really didn't even want to address that issue tonight, but I just thought I'd give you just a little bit of the background where this all came from, and we just didn't want to get into the mix on it. I mainly came about this moratorium, which I think is unnecessary. In fact, my wife mentioned as far as Mixed Use Area B. And the moratorium that you're proposing, actually, this zoning actually exists. If you read about Mixed Use Area B, this describes this exact area. And it is very restrictive. It's R1. It's the most restrictive in town. It actually, I could read through it, and because I know there's no public comment period when you're discussing it. But some of the things it states is all existing residences and commercial establishments in this area shall be considered conforming. The entire area is designated PD overlay. The proposed commercial use is generally waterborne clientele or water-oriented serving. This means above the bluff line is residential, below the bluff line is water-oriented commercial. This is the one area in Morro Bay that is actually, it's privately owned all the way to the waterfront. I'm out of time, but I'm sure other people will continue on. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Barbara Bribbs, and I own property in the area that they're discussing, and I've been here since 1936, and we've paid taxes on that property, and I don't like being upset. And I'm not happy right now. I really don't think you need to change the zoning. Like they said, it's very restrictive already. And I just want to voice my opinion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Often got a say as to what equipment would go out there. So we went into some in-depth discussions where some of the commissioners said, you know, a slide's a slide, put 7 slides out there. And there were a few of us with kids who said, no way, you know, a slide's not a slide, a zip line is better. Mm-hmm. And we sent that out to the school, and we went over, two commissioners, Commissioner Mahan and myself, We made storyboards, and we took them to the kids with a choice. We took them to their council, and their council spread out with these boards throughout the school, and each child took a vote. And at the end of it, the children voted for the large play structure, the large tower, to come in the big timber colors, which is the forest theme with kind of leaves and timbery looking brown and green, because they felt that the forest theme fit the park best. In addition to that, they were asked to choose whether they wanted play panels, several play panels, or whether they wanted what is called a Pegasus climber, which they referred to as the Eiffel Tower because of its shape, to replace the geodesic dome that's head entrapment out there. And they voted overwhelmingly, some of the classes, 31-0, for the climbing structure. So they made their choices, and we were ecstatic for them. We left this board up. They all came by. They all saw it in the end. And then it came back to us. And last week, we had a discussion at the Recs and Parks Commission meeting as to whether we should piggyback $20,000 onto the already $90,000. And we tried to get really good equipment, get it on sale, shipping to, and stay within our guidelines. And then it came back to us with $20,000 attached to it to work on the parking lot. And we looked at that, and we understood that the parking lot out there does need help. But we are under the belief that you go to the park to use the park, not to play in the parking lot. So we decided 7-0, unanimous decision, to come back to you and have you look at that and decide what you wanted to do, because we know that on the horizon is a tennis court. And
it would be very disrespectful to the planning staff and the planning committee to place a moratorium on something that already works. It's taken me 3 years to get my home built, and plenty of money and plenty of delays from the city. Don't delay anymore. Spend your time and money where we need it for children and for our water quality and our fire department. I've given money to the city. Let's don't waste any more time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Bob Kreiser from Los Osos. I'm a property owner in Morro Bay. And I'd like to address the issue of your proposed moratorium. It seems to me the issue that I faced when I ran a project through both the Planning Commission and the City Council was that we were asked to reduce mass and the term was bulk and scale, and we had to recreate the project. And through that process, basically through the planning process and through the appeal to your board and then back to the Planning Commission, we accomplished a project that was approved. That's a good functioning planning department. For an emergency moratorium to be placed on an area such as that without trusting your planning department is really making a negative statement on behalf of your planning department. If you feel like they need to make some improvements, then by all means it's in your purview to ask them to do so. But to put a moratorium on when they have essentially been doing a good job, I mean, I got beat up by them, but that meant they were doing a good job for you and for this community. And so I really think that it would be a mistake for you to put this moratorium on that area. Thanks.
Thank you.
Jay Coakley, 201 Main Street. I'm here to talk about the moratorium also. You guys heard pretty much about everything, except I'm concerned about the building permits. For example, we pulled one just about 2 weeks ago to have 100 yards of polluted soil removed. Under this new ordinance, you couldn't get any building permits. Well, our pollution's all gone, but meanwhile, we're under negotiations on renewing our lease and our docks. And if you read the fine print again, it's possible. It says no.
Proposed urgency ordinance and moratorium. We think the zoning in the area is adequate. We specifically wouldn't want the area north of Acacia included in any specific plan efforts. It's different character, different issues. If there are issues with the manner in which or design of buildings, that there are other tools for that that are probably more easily implemented and probably would work better for you. And we are in opposition to any action that may frustrate or prohibit the continued maintenance and repair that is always needed in the older homes that are prevalent in this area. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, Council. David Nelson. I live here in Morro Bay. I'm here first of all to say that, you know, the way the city handled our water disaster is scary. There's a responsibility up there to protect us. I don't really take it seriously, to be honest, after our city doesn't do anything at all about what's going on with the power plant and the pollution from it. So that said, I think something should be done because people were at risk. I mean, my wife wasn't pregnant, but she certainly got sick, and I thought I saw a link. And, you know, how many people are out there that suffered the same way? It's just not necessary. Pumping our wells during a dry period, you know, I think that contributed part to that. You know, the water studies that I've seen are really questionable about what's going on out there. Nobody's really asking a question, why is the water table so bad out there? Well, there's obvious reasons, but we'll let the scientists take care of that. I understand that Shell would like us to sign off on the MTB East bill. As a council, that would be so irresponsible of you. Look at up at Cambria, what's going on. Years after a so-called settlement may have happened up there, they're up there digging again. This stuff can't be contained properly. We heard a 0% of MTB would be released in our water when Roger Anderson was in mayor up there. Now we're going to have a state standard. We're getting MTB in our wells that are questionable to begin with. This is just adding pollution to them. And to sign off on a criminal act such as Shell's done because of, you know, information's out there. I know that some of you even know it, and it's just not right. And this pattern that we're putting out, our streets aren't getting fixed. We're all paranoid. We're all scared of something. I don't know what we're scared of, but we're in one of the best towns in the whole state. I went down by the estuary today. You can't even walk down by the state park anymore. Our town's being abused. I feel like, you know, an uncle watching a niece being abused by people that I know but can't do anything about it. I mean, this is a serious problem. Let's treat our town like we want to be treated. I mean, this is really bad what we're doing, and it's going to be long-term bad, you know. How many times have you heard what kind of fools will put a power plant in the middle of an estuary? Well, let's look around and see down the road when this comes up again, if we remember who the people are that did that. And I'm just asking that you guys work together and start taking care of some of these problems. It's, you know, spending more money on analyzing a sewer plant before you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Honorable Mayor, Council, staff, friends at home, I'm Joey Ricano with the Ocean Outfall Group. First thing I'd like to address is the nitrate issue. It's very interesting that your neighbors to the south, Los Osos, have been crucified for quite some time now for the nitrate levels in their groundwater. As a previous speaker with Surfrider Foundation had made clear, nitrates are often associated with other contaminants in the soil and in the water. I think that this points up, once again, the very logical need for a regional plan for the Morro Bay Estuary Watershed. I think that if you take a look at what the Region 1 Regional Water Quality Control Board has just implemented, they have come out for the North Coast with a comprehensive plan. I just got the PDF file from a friend. And they've come up with a comprehensive plan for the region. And it's really a wonderful plan. And I think that if the Region 1 Water Board can do it, then the Region 3 Water Board can do it. And right now, we have three cities all lined up, 1, 2, 3. Once again, I state the obvious. We all need wastewater treatment there as well. Also, since I'm not going to have time to stay, I did want to touch on A2, where the wastewater treatment alternatives analysis. Now, here's $45,000 down the drain to study a study on water treatment that won't include looking at recharging aquifers, and it won't look at recycling. So that's a complete waste of time. Those are two things that must be done. And then finally, the reauthorization of bringing a boat back in with a permit and to go out and fish experimentally. We tried that, and those who do not learn from the past are doomed to repeat it. They had regulations where they weren't supposed to be dragging the bottom at night or doing it in front of the mouth of the harbor, and yet they did, and then they collapsed the halibut industry as well. So I urge you to deny going along with that. Now, I thank you for this opportunity to address you tonight, and I hope everyone has a wonderful holiday.
Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Noah Smuckler, and I'm a Morro Bay resident, member of the Public Works Advisory Board, and speaking tonight as the Vice Chair of the San Luis Bay Chapter of the Surfrider Foundation. I'd like to start by welcoming the new council, and we look forward to a productive and positive year. And recently, our rains and first flush and the nitrate contamination issue in our wells have really brought back the point of and the necessity for us to examine and plan sustainably, to implement green planning techniques, as a lot of our neighboring cities and our county is beginning to do. The concepts of sustainability really depend on the idea of making decisions based on the triple bottom line, which is when we make a decision, we not only look at the economic impact of our decision, but also the social and environmental impact. And this way, we make a balanced decision that is the best for our long-term use of a land. And here in Morro Bay, we're directly tied, it appears to us here at Surfrider anyway, that we're directly tied to the health of our estuary for the health of our community. And by maintaining our estuary and protecting it and preserving it, we're looking out for our best interests both as a business community and a tourist community and for the health of our citizens. So, you know, we have the concept of the triple bottom line as we make these decisions down the road: people, planet, profit. It's very simple. And especially in the light of upcoming major decisions we have, one being the sewage treatment plant upgrade. And we at Surfrider have been firm supporters of the concept of going to reclamation ability and also tertiary. And it makes even more sense now when you look at the potential of our wells not being operable in the late summer months. Potentially, if this nitrate contamination doesn't clear up, we're going to have the same problem again next year, potentially. And we need to make this investment in our water supply because long-term, that's going to be one of the most valuable things that we have here in Morro Bay. And yeah, the desalination plant was very helpful, but let's do some things that don't require as much energy. And we do like the concept of going to ponding techniques and potentially using more space and creating a resource that not only treats sewage, but also is potentially open space and contributes to the environment of our community, such as the potential in the Choro Creek Valley. So I'd like to thank you again for hearing this, and good evening.
Thank you, Noah.
Good evening, Madam Mayor, members of the council. My name is John Barta. What a study and contrast I'm seeing on tonight's agenda, and at least in the public comment. First, item D1, and I'm going to urge you to vote no on item D1. Urgency ordinances are something that are really supposed to be done when there's a real health and safety need. So I'll read some of the language from your ordinance so everybody can know. Whereas the approval or adoption of additional projects in the area from Tidelands Park to Bayshore Bluffs within the city would result, and now this is the part I love, a threat to public health, safety, and welfare that they could alter in a radical and fundamental manner the current way of life in the city's residents, and blah, 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 and change the neighborhood care, overwhelm the capacity of the infrastructure to adequately service new you guys have to have a straight face when you say that's the case, okay? And I just don't think you can do that. But you're going to probably pass that thing, and then I have to contrast that with the nitrate in the water thing. Now, that's a real public health, safety, welfare issue where people are being, you know, poisoned lightly and heavily in some cases by water that's foul. All you had to do there was send a notice out with the water bill a month and a half. You know when you're going to be on well water. All you have to do is put the notice out and people can know. So there was a chance there.
Give the moment of background that in my past career, I'm a physician, this includes certification, public health, and preventive medicine, and have served as a county health officer and a city health officer for cities both larger and smaller than Morro Bay, including dealing with problems with such as we recently experienced. And I think something needs to be done, and what needs to be done is called the lessons learned approach. There's obvious questions, which are simply, what are the existing emergency policies and procedures for the water system, the emergency plans, what types of emergencies are anticipated under the current set of plans, and it's obvious this was not fully anticipated. And when you ask what types are anticipated, you get into considerations of better understanding of the hydrology. What are the triggers for an emergency plan? And then you'll get into the considerations of defining them and monitoring them. Were the implemented emergency plans implemented as planned? And even if they were they adequate? If they were, why? If they weren't, why not? And if things can be done better? Do we need revisions or drills? The lessons learned approach is built around using the experience to do better in the future. It doesn't work if it's built around finding someone to blame, someone to say someone did wrong. It won't work if the agencies involved, and sometimes it's hard, you know, being on that side, I realize, fall into being defensive, justify, or rationalize. The lessons learned approach is simply about self-criticism and constructive criticism from the outside to do better in the future. I think it would be very important in this case to include the city health officer, and as I'm sure the council, but maybe not the public, knows, the council has appointed, unless things have radically changed, the county health officer as their city health officer, because the city is required to have one, to include the city health officer or designee in a major role in doing the lessons learned, because this will not be the only problem of this type of emergency. This is different than you have a
park owner, but also as a Morro Bay resident and taxpayer. I would like to add that I have absolutely no intention of closing or converting my park. Actually, it's ironic that the city has undertaken the only park conversion in town when it closed Bayview on the waterfront. My opposition based in what has happened in other jurisdictions, and because our current regulatory framework already provides protection for affordable housing, as our city attorney outlined in his staff report. Experience in other jurisdictions has shown that conversion ordinances are expensive to implement, are extremely contentious, and don't work very well. This is because the ordinances cannot begin to address the host of conflicting goals and individual situations that parks, tenants, and policymakers are in. For example, there are many different types of parks. Some parks are so substandard that the best option is closure. Given location, rent control, and other regulatory hurdles, upgrades of these parks may never happen. However, conversion ordinances keep these parks open, an institutionalized slum ordinance, if you will. Other parks may not have proper zoning. If a jurisdiction wants to force these parks to stay open, then they need to rezone the property. Now you bring the park's neighbors into play and the issue of spot zoning, which our city attorney has told me is illegal. Conversion ordinances also lead to conflicts among tenants, especially if park owners wish to sell shares or spaces to their tenants. Tenant park ownership is something California state law has encouraged and has protection policies for those mobile homeowners who want to remain renters. However, conversion ordinances tend to block park sales to tenants, pitting tenants who want to be park owners against who want to be renters. Our county faced different interests among tenant groups during its deliberations. One park's tenants lobbied heavily for an ordinance banning conversion, while those in another park lobbied to allow conversion to tenant subdivision ownership. Curiously, some tenants who initially fought for a conversion ordinance are now unhappy because they fear that an ordinance will become a roadmap on how to close a park. Because of many conflicting situations, the county, after more than a year and countless hours of hearings, meetings, and staff time, not to mention the many upset tenants and park owners, still doesn't have an ordinance. Instead, the Board of Supervisors must now decide on whether to implement a two-year conversion moratorium to give time for even more deliberation and analysis. It seems to me that this is a situation where the government is trying to square the circle, and as such, more government is not the answer. I would encourage the council to take no action at this time and to just monitor the situation. We do not get tenants and park owners worked up on this issue. I don't see a host of parks closing, and the city can deal with those that might on a case.
And happen to be the lucky recipient. So, once again, I'm not the one involved in that. I can't say it didn't happen, but I just don't happen to be the one involved. So,
any other responses? Okay, Rob, a couple of things. The Shell actually asked us to sign off on the MTBE. What's that about?
No, Shell has never asked us to be released from their MTBE obligations, and we would never do that. What they have asked to do is they've asked the Regional Water Quality Control Board, which is in charge of the MTBE cleanup, they've asked for closure of the site. What that means is they no longer would have to do any more remediation, and they wouldn't have to do the monitoring. We've resisted that for the last year and said we don't believe it should even be closed. Sooner or later, it'll be a hearing in front of the Regional Water Quality Control Board. But even when a site is closed, that doesn't release them from liability. It just means, like I said, they don't have to do any more remediation or the monitoring. So, but at no time have they said they want to be released, and staff certainly wouldn't recommend that.
Okay. And Bob Hendricks, about the nitrates in the water and that whole situation. I know that the city did a recap and a study of what happened and how it happened, and I like Mr. Dorfman's idea about a lessons learned attitude. Can you give us a report on that and how everything went?
Well, I think what Dr. Dorfman had to say really supports what the staff's been saying, which is we are trying to learn from the process and improve wherever necessary. I did want to make a couple of points without getting into too much detail. First is a real basic point, and that is it is the goal of the staff and the city to continuously provide pure and safe drinking water to the residents of the city. That's our goal. That's very important to us, and we strive to do that. We do not want to repeat problems of the past, and we'll do whatever we can do. We'll concoct scenarios and do the planning as best we can to avoid any kind of scenario that would bring us into this kind of problem with nitrates ever again. As far as our emergency plans, we have an adopted formal emergency plan related to the water system. It mainly contemplates things like natural disaster or explosion or sabotage. It creates on an every 3-month basis, and we would be required to report those results to the state. The state has a standard for that, which is 45 milligrams per liter. That's the state standard. We did test our wells prior to the time that the state water project went on its maintenance outage. And the wells in the city, on the average, I'm going to, for simplicity here, I want to say I'm going to use one result that really represents a cluster of results, but one result. The one result that I would share with you is that the wells tested around 26 milligrams per liter level. This is prior to the time we went into the outage. Now, the coastal branch outage began on November 6th. The city began production from local wells and daily testing at that time. So we test every day. The samples that were taken on November 7th and returned to us on November 8th showed 19 milligrams per liter as the level of nitrate concentration in our water, which is well below the state standard of 45. However, on we roll forward to November 15th, the samples that were returned to us from the testing on the 15th showed a nitrate level of 48 milligrams per liter, which is 3 milligrams per liter higher than the state standard. And once we got that information, certain processes were kicked in motion, the first being a notification of state health, which is our legal requirement when we have these kinds of issues. We apprised them of the problem. Oh, well, I want to back up and say one more thing. I'm sorry to get out of the context of a chronology, but I want to go back and say that before the outage began, we did test our wells and we did formally come up with an operating plan to deal with the outage time. And both the well data and our operating plan were submitted to State Health for their review and approval, which they did. So the plan under which we were operating for the outage was a plan that was approved by the State Health. The operating plan itself did assume that nitrates would increase in the water during the outage. On the 15th, as I said, we received samples back that said 48 milligrams per liter. We notified the state. The other action that we took in response was to stop production on three wells, which two tested above the limit in that sample, and one was near the limit, and we shut all three of those wells down with the eye that we would reduce water production but also reduce nitrate levels. So that was the goal of that. The remaining wells that remained in production had, prior to the outage, showed nitrate levels at around 10 milligrams per liter, which is well below the state standard. The state staff gave us direction to prepare what is known as a Tier 1 nitrate notice. Now, the Tier 1 nitrate notice is an advisory. It's not an emergency warning that the water is contaminated. It's not a danger signal that you should stop using the water. It's an advisory. And a part of the notice says that nitrate is a serious health concern for infants under 6 months and fetuses. So there's a target population that's of concern to state health in this notice. The following morning, on November 16th, the notice went to local TV, local physicians, public health clinics, renal care facilities, and whatever locations were also called for in our emergency plan, our response plan. So we did do the noticing according to the plan. New samples were also taken that Thursday morning and sent to the lab for expedited handling. The results of those came back and showed that nitrate levels had actually increased a notch, and we were at 49 milligrams per liter as opposed to the day before at 48. So that was not good news. At that point, we made a decision to further curtail well production to just two wells and also began activities to mobilize the desalinization plant. The county was contacted to see if emergency deliveries out of the state water system were possible during the outage because of the problem. The county responded and committed to deliveries of 200 gallons per minute, and that was about equal to 40% of our water demand. So the remainder had to come from, at least for the moment, had to come from wells, shore extraction wells. They're basically seawater. So the idea there is you can operate the plant much more efficiently than if you're trying to push seawater through it. And it will take the nitrate out, incidentally. That's the purpose of the plant. And then back to my chronology. Samples, further samples were taken and read. The results of those came back on the 17th, which is Friday. The nitrate levels were down to 46, which is just one notch above the state limit. A second sample was taken, and that results of that were received late in the day on Friday, and those showed 9 milligrams per liter. So we had a dramatic drop in our nitrate level in the course of the period of time between the end of the day on Thursday and the middle of the day on Friday. We decided to go ahead and run the desal plant using the Morrow Wellfield for a resource. Its production was 380 gallons per minute, which is roughly 50% of what we needed at the time. And at the same time, the State Water Project, in spite of their commitment to only 200 gallons per minute, increased their deliveries to 400 gallons a minute because the maintenance crew on the coastal branch had accelerated their maintenance project and placed the treatment plant at Colonial Pass back into production several days early. So state water production began again, and there was again water in the coastal branch. And I hope that's of help to everybody. The main point I want to get across clearly to everyone is our goal is to make sure the water is safe and that we're giving everybody a safe and pure domestic water product to use. We don't want to have people concerned about their health or concerned about using the water or anything else. The notices that we did give, though, are pursuant to state regulation and our own emergency plan. We do plan, we have reviewed and do plan to continue looking at our interaction, if you will, with the media on this and to see if there are more effective ways we can do this. We don't want to alarm the public, and we certainly don't want to alarm the public needlessly if we have a development that doesn't really constitute a general emergency. But on the other hand, you don't want to create a situation where people are concerned because
we are all concerned about it. We do want to learn lessons from this, and we do want to make sure that it is handled even better. I mean, everything was done legally and according to the procedures, but that doesn't mean that we can't do more and do it better. So we will discuss it and certainly welcome your suggestions and ideas for that. We'll agendize it for a public hearing. All right, and future agenda items is right now. So who would like to agendize that? Okay. Let's agendize future notices of any sort of difficulty or safety issue. I think that's the main concern, is how the notice gets out and what our procedures are. And I think it would be nice to have those reviewed for the public and perhaps updated and changed. Okay?
Did you just call that a public hearing when you were just talking about it, I thought?
I just said that I was agendizing it for a public hearing.
Okay.
Do I have support from the council on that?
Yes.
All right. That's unanimous. So that will require a staff report. The other one that I would like to agendize is, we discussed this once before, I'm going to try it again. I would like to put a moratorium on marijuana dispensaries within the city limits until we can discuss the proper locations and number that we desire to have here. And I would look for council support for that discussion.
I'll support that.
One? Okay, that's four of us. So yes, we would like that agendized. Betty, no. The rest of us, yes. All right. Any other future agenda items? Betty?
I'd like to know, and I don't know if this is necessarily an agenda item, but where we are and with the AGP contract, it came to my mind as we're talking about charter tonight, mm-hmm. and so I think that we're without a contract, and I'd like to have a report on that.
Okay. I agree with that. Okay.
Do you want a memo on that, or is it just where we are in the status and then see if you want it as a future agenda
item? That's what I don't know.
Because I mean,
it's a memo first, I think, just to find out what the status is. And then
we could write up a status report for you, and then you'd have the background information, could decide what you want to do.
Okay.
That work?
Sure.
Okay. Anything else?
Yes, and I'd like to try something I tried a few years ago, and that's talk about proposing an ex parte disclosure when we're dealing with projects. It's something that I brought up 4 years ago, and I'd like to try that again. So I've already got the staff report, and I'll just bring it back.
Okay.
And do you...
All right, great. All right, let's take a short break before we start our consent calendar. Yeah. I mean short. Let's take until 25 till, 7 minutes. Okay, we're back. All right, with the consent agenda, I have a question for City Clerk. We continued the minutes from our December 6th meeting, so is that on this consent agenda as well or not?
No, because that agenda went out before the special meeting.
Okay, so even though it was continued, it doesn't come up until our next one.
It will not be on until the first meeting in January.
January, okay. I just wasn't sure about that, and I brought them along in case. So, on this consent agenda, who would like to pull anything?
A2 and A3.
Okay. Do I hear a motion approving A1?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? None. All right, Betty, A2.
This is the award of contract for the city wastewater treatment alternatives analysis in the Chorro Valley. And it's something that came up at our JPA meeting with Cayucas, and, I guess it didn't. We said we would do it on our own. I had concerns because I thought that, unlike Noah Smuckler or Matt Fleming, I think one of them, surf riders, brought up the idea that we need to have other alternatives examined as well besides just creek discharge. And I remember when we talked about this earlier, that I had also wanted to know about injection and reclamation with the ranchers and farmers. And I spoke with Mr. Keogh about that today and asked if he could find out the cost differential to add one or both of those options to this scope, and I don't know if he was able to get any information back.
Mr. Keogh?
Yeah, I did speak with Mr. Kramer at Cannon Associates today, and we discussed a little bit about, you know, I explained to Councilmember Winholtz why we had basically looked at the creek discharge option rather than including groundwater injection and or irrigation options. And when I spoke with Mr. Kramer today, he said basically they'd gone back and looked at both phase one and phase two of the Boyle studies, and those studies had concentrated on really, this first option or this first phase of the study that we're looking at is really a fatal flaw analysis. Are there things in here that could prevent the project from moving forward? And his comment was that if you wanted to look at creek discharge, certainly the requirements for creek discharge would be as stringent, perhaps more stringent, than what you'd get for reclamation and irrigation. Mm-hmm. So his thought process is maybe we could push that back into the phase two approach, because we really wrestled with the scope of work and trying to keep the cost down and try and get the most bang for the buck in terms of the technical review.
And are we approving just phase one or phase one and phase two tonight?
You would just be approving the phase one, and if we get to the point where we want to pursue phase two, we would bring that scope of work back for your review and award and a further award. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for doing that.
I have a question.
Yes.
Okay. Just to be clear, when I looked at page 4 of this contract, or not the contract, but the letter of offer from Cannon, there's a part 1 and a part 2, and I see part 1 says $45,000, and then are these the phase 1 and phase 2?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, I just want to make sure, because I thought that the phase 2 had actually had a higher expense, and that's why you decided to put it off, but it doesn't. It's very
the upfront cost is of $45,000 is the initial phase that's, or mm-hmm. the initial part one that's outlined in here.
Right, and so only if we went to phase two, this other $17,000.
That's correct.
And all we're approving tonight is phase one.
That's correct.
Okay. And the other question, we talk about water reclamation on chapter 3 of your staff report. And I also am very interested in recharging aquifers and including that, because I think that that's where our wells are, is out there in the Chorro Flats, isn't it?
Yeah, that's correct.
Was that where we were testing for the nitrates?
I believe so.
That's one location.
One of the locations.
Yeah, just one of the locations.
So I would certainly like that tossed in as a way of avoiding that kind of a, in order to see if we want to recharge that basin out there.
When I spoke to Mr. Boucher, he's probably the most knowledgeable person about that aspect of the project. His comments were that both Morro and Choro Valleys have, because of the geology, mm-hmm. that they're not true aquifers in the sense of what a true aquifer. The comments I got from Bill were that both of the irrigation and the groundwater recharge have been looked at by the city on numerous reclamation studies, and they've never really been able to make those options viable.
So the boil studies, the findings from those back in the late 90s could still be applicable now because they're not impacted by costs or permitting changes.
In terms of the viability of the groundwater recharge?
Right.
Yeah, I believe so. And I think that the Carollo Wastewater Reclamation Study in 1999 okay. addressed groundwater recharge as well.
Just one other question. And I would also recognize, Bruce, that Mr. Boucher is probably the guy to be asking these questions. But this thing about the grant money for tertiary or quaternary treatment, and it says... you know, we go into this kind of language, may have a good opportunity, then I say how good, for receiving grant funding, because it's the grant funding that will reduce impact on ratepayers if we go to tertiary and reduce flow and things like that. It may not be known for some time if grant funding is available. Now, then you say we have to decide on alternatives by the end of 2007, so I'm just wondering if the sometime about grant funding might happen before the end of 2007.
Originally, when we had discussed the scope with Mr. Kramer, he had pushed the grant funding back into the part two or the phase two portion of it. We requested that he move that up because obviously that's a very critical component to this project. So Cannon will be looking at grant funding sources and some of the funding sources that were outlined in the Boyle study, and I think that'll give us a better idea of what may or may not be available.
Any other questions, Rick?
Hi, Bruce. So the recharging issue, the main issue against that is the geological features of the area?
That's my understanding.
And I understand that we've talked with a few potential customers on reclaimed water, but it would narrow down using that type of water would narrow down the type of crop that they could grow because of the water itself that's...
That's correct. It depends on the chloride content and some of the mineral constituents, I believe.
Okay. And also, I understand that one person that has expressed interest in it wants only if he can get the water for free. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Of A2.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? None. All right. A3, Betty.
A3 is a resolution to execute a grant agreement of $130,000 from the State Coastal Conservancy to support transitioning San Luis County harbors and commercial fisheries to a sustainable future. It's a long title. And this encompasses not just our harbor, but also San Luis Harbor. And I am basically, of course, in favor of this. I did have a concern about how this would be monitored and equitably distributed. And I asked Mr. Algert if he could address that tonight.
Yeah, thank you for sending, good evening, Mayor and Council, first off. Thank you for sending me that inquiry this morning. And I'm not sure I understand how it would be monitored. Maybe I could ask you additional question on that. Can you tell me a little more what you had in mind?
On the second page of your report, it lists that there's three projects attached to this money.
Right.
And one's new gear, one's a marketing, and one's a sustainable fisheries business plan. And since we're dealing with two communities here, Morro Bay as well as Avila, how does that get divvied up? And then within each community, is it like people come and apply to you, and are you distributing the money? How does that work?
Good, thank you. Well, okay, so there's three components. The first one is the sea trials on a low-impact trawl fishery. That is going to be one vessel that is owned along with the permits by the Nature Conservancy through their buyback. And we are working with one fisherman who will be able to execute that sea trials. He will have to execute an agreement outside of the city with to lease the vessel and permit from TNC, which they are working on now. And on that particular element, that will be in Morro Bay, work out of here, and we are going to reimburse the costs for fuel and hard reimbursables such as safety gear, net modifications. The most of the risk in that situation will be borne by that individual fisherman. The purpose is to attempt to identify more sustainable or environmentally preferred gear and try and target these fisheries, the deep water complex fisheries, which previously had major landings in this port, had sustained us a petrolley, Dover Soles. Planning firm to A, assist local fishermen in promoting their vessel and story in high-end markets, B, assist with making a connection between high-end fish buyers, such as Clean Fish or Fishwise, and media, Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch Program, and local sustainable fishing operations. In other words, we're trying to find a marketing consultant who would be interested in helping our local sustainable fishing operations connect up with buyers who are interested in this product, potentially put kits together, which is what a lot of restaurants want to do now, show where the fish came from, how it's caught, and just basically assist in that. And that is a matter of working out a program and submitting it to the Coastal Conservancy as a part of the requirement of the work program, which might be another part of your monitoring question. All of this has to be submitted in a work program to the Coastal Conservancy, and then there is final reports that are due too. The third, the longer term element, is to do a business plan for sustainable fisheries in this county, and that may be something you're curious about too, how well the two ports sort of split that up. We have worked with Port San Luis staff on this, and they did send in a letter, and Port San Luis Harbor District sent in a letter of support. They're fully aware of this. What we'd like to do would be to share the work a little bit and actually turn that portion of the program over their staff to manage, and I think we've got that agreement from them. So I think that they'll have more of a say in that portion of the program than we will. Did that answer some of your questions?
It's a little better defined in that some of it's yet to be done. This is more of a work program, it sounds like, and then it comes back later, and then the actual – it's more paperwork now, I should say, and then it comes back, and then the actual work's done, it sounds like, at least on Project 2, like the marketing program that you're suggesting, that
right.
Both communities will be equally promoted, and that the business plan is an outgrowth of the marketing plan, or are they two separate plans?
They are two separate plans. I think they could overlap, and to some extent, in that we see that the marketing plan is an attempt to immediately do what we see we need to do, which is to find higher dollar, lower volume markets. And everybody's aware now that there's a increasing demand for the Whole Foods type fish, where you can find out where it is and it's branded sustainably. So to try and enter into that market is the marketing effort is immediately targeting that. The business plan is more of a long-range effort to see what our real opportunities are and give us a plan instead of just being our fishermen here have been reacting. Trials, there's not an opportunity. I mean, I'd be happy to work with fishermen who are interested in the marketing study and help us work through that. That would be correct.
I have a question.
Any other questions? Yeah, Melody.
On the list of assurances, number two says that the applicant will have sufficient funds available to meet its own share of the cost for projects. And I think in your staff report, you talked about this having no fiscal impact on the city's harbor fund. So I'm wondering, where would this, our own share of the cost for projects, come from then?
We will list a lot of in-kind time as the city's share, which would basically be my salary working on this, which I could, you know, work on these kind of projects and sort of in addition to all my other duties. So I feel like it's essentially no additional cost to the city since you pay me a salary, but we will list a significant in-kind contribution from the city for administration.
In other words, marking out a portion of your salary, your hours spent on this project.
Yes.
And, of course, that's not taking you away from the myriad other duties that you have.
Well, it does. I mean, the truth is, but we try and get it all done, too. But, you know, yeah, we spend a lot of time working on this.
Okay. Mary, do you have a question?
Hi, Rick. First of all, I just want to preface it by saying I think it's great that, that the Coastal Conservancy and the fishermen are, seem to be working together, you know, to do something to help the fishing industry. The sea trials, where might they be expected to? Is that going to be in Port St. Louis and Morro Bay or one of the two? Or?
Mostly it's the vessel. The vessel will be leased back from the Nature Conservancy is the, oh, my goodness. The South Bay, tied up at the South T Pier. Most likely, they will operate out of Morro Bay and land their fish here in Morro Bay, although it is possible with seasons there. There's highly restricted now areas that they can trawl in. So all between the essential fish habitat that we negotiate, our local fishermen negotiated with the Nature Conservancy and Environmental Defense, those protections, and the Rockfish Conservation Area, has basically eliminated all the hard bottom, virtually all the hard bottom trawling areas. So they will, you know, the one other comment on that too is there's a vessel monitoring system required with every A permit so they can tell with their 30 feet where the vessel is at all times, if that was your curiosity, like actual fishing grounds. But they'll basically go out fishing and probably return to Morro Bay, although weather could depend.
Okay.
First of all, good evening, Mayor and City Council. Just a little bit of history on this project for you. Delmar Park was originally constructed in 1980, and at that time a wooden play structure was installed. The play structure has served the community very well. However, in the last, I'd say, 7 to 10 years, the Parks Department has taken out certain things on the structure that are not safe, tire swings, swinging bridge, that sort of thing. They've also repaired or performed numerous repairs for rotting wood and worn-out parts and pieces in general. Several of the parks in Morro Bay, or play structures in Morro Bay, were in similar condition. Kaiser Park and Monty Young Park, both have been renovated over the last 5 years, and we used some competitive grant funding for both those parks from the California Integrated Waste Management Board. It was a great funding source. It paid for 75% of the play structures. Unfortunately, that source has dried up at this point, and that's why we're recommending the use of a portion of the 2002 Parks Bond per capita funds for this project. The Recreation and Parks Commission originally reviewed the Del Mar Playground project at their September meeting, and they asked us to come back at their October meeting because the structure that we provided at the September meeting wasn't very exciting. They told us, quite frankly, they wanted some unique things. They wanted something different, something that you wouldn't see in every park up and down the coast. We came back to the October meeting. We put in some interesting things. I think Commissioner Solu talked a little bit about a zip line that's going to be put in. And the commission liked the unique project that we provided, but they did ask that we leave some choices up to the students at Del Mar School. Del Mar is adjacent to Del Mar Park, and the students use the park quite a bit. So we left some choices up to the students, things like a decision on play panels and colors and whether they wanted a climbing structure or not. Our commissioners worked with Del Mar Student Council and Principal Don Schallenberger and went on the road with their presentation, visited all the classrooms, and the children voted, and they were pretty excited about the possibility of having a choice in what we're going to be putting in the park. They were also amazed at the amount of money that a structure like that cost. I think their eyes got pretty big when we talked about $90,000. That's a big sum. We brought this item, as you're aware, to the October 23rd meeting, and the council at that point discussed the project and asked us whether or not it talked about the park in general and the condition of the parking lot, which we certainly know is not in great condition, and the possibility of whether or not these Bond Act funds are usable for a parking lot. At that October meeting, we weren't sure, so we went back and talked to State Parks, who oversees these funds. And we have an in-house staff person that now does our playground inspections. They've gone through the inspection training. The existing play structure does not meet safety specifications in a number of areas. And I'll just give you a couple of those. We have inadequate access for mobility-limited individuals. The protective surfacing that we have, which is basically the sand, is not adequate for the height of the existing play structure. There's not enough cushion there. There's head entrapment issues on the slides and ladders. We have inadequate handrails, as well as some basic wear and tear.
after the council meeting and based on the council's question, we talked to the city engineer and had a site visit on the parking lot, and we were able to obtain a quote to do some repair on the parking lot, not a complete parking lot replacement. That's extremely expensive, but a repair that would certainly help. We would be looking at 30 tons of asphalt, some slurry sealing, and some new striping for that parking lot, which is about $16,000 or $17,000. We took that recommendation back to the Recreation and Parks Commission on last Thursday night to see if the commission would be interested in putting another $20,000 towards the project. And the commission did vote 7-0 to move ahead with the playground project, or to recommend moving ahead with the playground project, but defer the parking lot repair, not fund that not recommend funding those additional monies until the tennis court project is completed, because, as the council is aware, the tennis court project is going to be very destructive to the parking lot because the amount of dirt that's going to be moved in and out for the tennis courts. So the commission was concerned, and they did have a fairly lengthy discussion about it because they certainly understand the concerns, but their concern was that the parking lot's going to need some serious repair after the tennis court project. That concludes my staff report. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Sorry, my mic was not on.
I do have some comments. With the up in the airness about when the tennis courts might be done, if it was going to be within the next 12 months, fine, let's defer the parking lot. I haven't had that sense from Ms. Luker that's going to be done within the next year. And so my feeling is that we're redoing the playground. We're actually putting in ADA sidewalks, but that parking lot is not ADA accessible. I mean, if you get out, you fall into a hole. There's ripples in it. It's just very broken up. And I think it's worth the $16,000 or $18,000.
The parking lot. Otherwise, I think the equipment, I think it's a good concept. I know that's quite a popular park, but I also don't see the tennis courts going in before that parking lot's completely gone.
Rick?
I'm probably asking a question that I'm the only person in the room doesn't know the answer to, but the per capita funds, is that for Park and Rec or other city departments? Is it strictly Park and Rec?
Thank you. That's a good question. It has to be limited to the park land. It was when the Bond Act passed, there were some restrictions placed on it, so it's limited to the parks and park improvements.
And is that a fund that is reloaded every year with money that we have end date to spend?
Unfortunately not. There were two bond acts that passed, one in 2000 and one in 2002. In 2000, the city received $90,000 of per capita money. We get it based on our size, per capita, obviously. And we used it on three projects from the 2000. This amount from the 2002 Bond Act was $220,000 the city receives or gets. We basically have to make application to state parks and propose our project, and then we get the money reimbursed. It's not money that we currently have in the bank. It's guaranteed that we get the money, but we have to have our project approved. There were some bonds that passed in the last election. They weren't as specific as these two park bond acts, and parks and recreation may end up getting some per capita funds, but we're waiting from the state to find out exactly. So your answer is maybe.
Okay. Thank you, Andrew.
Melody? Rick, I'm sorry. Were you finished with you? Okay. Melody?
Yeah, I'm a little confused. $110,000, that's for the play structure and the repairs to the parking lot, but what pays for the two walkways and the resurfacing underneath the structure?
Thank you. Good question. The $90,000 is inclusive. The playground equipment is at or about $45,000, $50,000, $55,000. The surfacing, the sidewalks are included in that. So that's the whole project is approximately $90,000.
Okay. During the break, I was getting different information from Ms. Solu, but
install
is
fairly expensive, $25,000 or so.
That I believe the parking lot repairs will have washed away by the time the tennis courts go in, and I wish them luck. But the other thing I hadn't really realized until Councilmember Wendholz brought this up is that the parking lot really doesn't feel very ADA to me right now. I'd hate to be in a wheelchair getting out and trying to go in there with a dog or kids and go through that surface. So I think it would be good to go ahead and include the parking lot resurfacing.
My question, Andrea, is did you look at just fixing the potholes in the parking lot, or was that not practical?
When I went out with the city engineer, Frank Cunningham, we tried to look at the least expensive that's going to last. We've done spot cold mix and hot mix in the spots that are bad, but we tried to look at something that's going to last a little bit. So we certainly could, you know, fill in the bad spots, but that's what we've been doing.
Well, I too appreciate Parks and Rec, and I know they did have that discussion. I caught some of it on TV, but I tend to agree. I think that by the time we will be ready to do the tennis courts, we will have to redo the parking lot again. So I think to do this temporary fix and make it nice would be a good idea, because it hasn't been nice for a long time. It's a very deteriorated parking lot. Okay, so who wants to make a motion? Let Rick okay. win. Okay, his first motion.
Okay, thanks. Monumental. I make the motion that we approve C1 as written, as recommended.
Do I hear a second?
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? None. Thank you. Okay, and then we go to new business D1, and this is the interim urgency ordinance regarding land use permits for projects from Main Street to the Bay and from Bayshore Bluffs to Tidelands Park. And Rob, you going to do the staff report here?
I'll just introduce it and I'll turn it over to Councilmember Pierce. It was his future agenda item. It is an interim urgency ordinance I have put up there, although it doesn't come in really clear. So maybe someone can come out from AGP and maybe increase the size of it. But that's from all, that's a APN map of from Olive down to Bayshore Drive, which is the area of the interim urgency ordinance that if it is approved from you, it will require a 4/5 vote. Questions regarding, they're not something that we should do willy-nilly, and you need to make certain that there is a very hard concern that you have for this area in order to do it. From a staff standpoint, what we would do if you do approve this is within that 45-day period, we would research what it would cost for a consultant to do, and there's different ways to go about it. I mean, this is just scratching the surface because since it takes 4/5 vote, staff doesn't put a lot of time in it like we did with the North Morro Bay, but we would need to get a consultant on board, or you'd have to re-look at your priorities in January to see where you'd want to put this. But it doesn't necessarily mean there'd be a zoning change. It could be done by a specific plan. It could be done by design guidelines if you determine that this area needs a fix to it. And so I'll turn it over to Bill for his thoughts and if there's any of my thoughts. There are quite a few lots that you can't see down in that area that are quite large that could be susceptible to subdivisions or subdivided and made into smaller lots, and I think that's one of the current concerns that Councilmember Pierce had, along with making sure that the waterfront still remains a viable waterfront leases along that area.
Okay, Bill.
There's not much left to say other than the fact that, you know, I don't have any specific idea, plan, or whatever in mind. When I brought this up, I hadn't really even thought. I know a number of people have been concerned we're going to come along and rezone it or something, and I think what we're looking at is a significant portion of what used to be the working waterfront, and the property there had was interacting with that commercial viability. It's maybe all R1, but there was access from the public to various portions of that. There were, you know, working facilities, and that is changing. Now, it may be a good thing, it may be a bad thing, but that's a big chunk of the future of what is Morro Bay, and part of the charm of Morro Bay is sitting there. And I just want to make sure that when that we're looking 10 years down the road and we're comfortable with that portion of the bay. I think somebody, I know staff has mentioned the planning. It's not like we don't have confidence in our public services people, our planning people. This is not a slap at them. What it is an opportunity for
different areas put together. There's two different zones here, and one abuts the waterfront and one doesn't. And so I'm just curious as to, would you want to limit it to, if this involves water concerns, just to the south end, or is it the whole area? It's also the upland that you're concerned about.
Well, basically, for the most part, everything south of Tidelands Park and north of Bayshore Bluffs has access to water, or most of it. And that's the part I'm concerned about. I think really. I know there was some issues brought up regarding, gee, you can't replace a roof or you can't fix a water heater or something like that. That's not, I think, what we have in mind if we do this. Maintenance is something that obviously should be allowed. It's just if someone comes in with a project, then what we need to do is be comfortable with the fact that the project's going to fit what we, the new council, feel is the future of the city.
That answer your question, Betty?
It doesn't. It doesn't. My understanding of the northern properties is that they actually abut the Tidelands parking lot rather than the
I'm talking about south of the parking lot.
Then you would be talking the southern half of this property, I think,
right,
from Acacia down.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, obviously, there's the Tidelands parking lot is a buffer between that property and mm-hmm. and it has public access and all of that. I mean, it's unaffected by whatever happens on the property above it, whereas south of that, there's, you know, it's directly connected and mm-hmm. and there is no buffer.
Mm-hmm. Melanie, questions, comments?
What is the current zoning in this area? I believe that it's R1 with a PD overlay and then a mixed area B, although I thought it was in the waterfront, but
yeah, there's two different zoning. There's R2, which was from Olive on over, and then it begins R1 from about where Councilmember Pierce stated where he thought it would start, and then actually right before Bayshore Bluffs, my understanding is it goes back to R2. So that's the zoning for it.
So some of it on Main Street is R1 and some of it is R2.
Correct. And then it's in what's called a mixed area B, which does have some guidelines. From a staff standpoint, talking to planners, there is some guidelines, but they certainly would like to have more guidance when someone comes in with the proposal for subdivision to know exactly what their recommendations should be in that area.
If I may correct the numbers, that if in fact we do nothing and we just let it go as a PD overlay, it's conceivable that we could see developments in there with, say, 18 homes. Is that correct? 18 is your number?
I don't know. It's tough to tell. I mean, I don't know all that are certainly joined by ownership right now.
In January of 2006, we prevented them from doing something down there at 217, 219, 221, which I believe was that property. And the history on that is that the old PC, the ones that we retired, gave a lot line adjustment to those lots that created three really horrible lots to design on. Okay, that was a lot line adjustment that took a 12,000 square foot lot and took them to 4,300, 4,100. And the staff was actually okay with that at the counter. The thing is, I remember when I ran for city council that I said that the system begins at the counter, then works up to the planning commission, then works up to us. And in this case, with the new planning commission, they turned down the building plans that were brought forward, as you recall, in those really oddly shaped lots to try to squeeze three huge houses, and it's inside this area. And then when the owner-builder appealed it to council, and staff was recommending to us again that we uphold the appeal, we turned it down 3-2. We said no. And the thing is, I believe that if we The problem with this is, okay, is that you drive down there, and I've gone there down there since I heard this coming on the agenda, like every other day, just to look at it. It is absolutely one of the most remarkable areas in Morro Bay. And in fact, it's becoming less and less that we have remarkable areas like that in Morro Bay, but that is absolutely remarkable. And I've often wondered, Bill, who lives there, and when they're not there, what will happen? So, but I'm just wondering, with this kind of zoning down there, and R2 never bothers me because they'll just want to do R1 anyway, that if we have these lots and we just say no to them, and we say this is an absolutely priceless area, you have to come back with a better plan. These are at our discretion, I believe, and we get to choose what will happen down there. Our planning commission and our staff at the counter gets to choose. And I'm saying that, kind of wondering where this is all going to go. But the problem for me is that I look down there and I see an area that looks fine and has historically looked fine. Now, I did ask about, so we have that already in place. But I worry that since planning commissions come and go, and so do councils, that if we leave this up to some kind of a process in this house, you know, with an area that really has restrictive zoning already and really can be turned down for nearly anything, that we're just simply going to open up a Pandora's box with this process. That it's been resting still, and we're going to go fiddle with it. And every time we fiddle with stuff, it seems like it just opens it up to strange things.
Rick?
Yeah, I'm certainly not thinking about rezoning anything down there. But, you know, we were just talking about helping our fishermen. And I think a working waterfront is an important thing if we're going to have a fishing industry. So I think those two kind of go together. The moratorium Bill's talking about would last 45 days. I don't think we're impeding anyone's plans or livelihood. There's nothing that's been turned in for that area. But I really don't think it's an emergency at this point either, because we will have the opportunity to yay or nay any projects that go there. So I'm kind of on the fence on this one.
Well, I am too. I mean, I know the purpose behind it. I know that what we're trying to do is to prevent losing that special area. And I know that we have the ability to do that now. I think that it's not fair, however, to, unless we can do this in our meeting with the Planning Commission and really clarify what we feel about development in that area and what it should and shouldn't be, it's not fair to put it on staff to say, well, okay, this is what's legal, this is what the council has said no to, you know, take your chances. I would like to give people who are bringing projects in there a little bit more guidance on that so that they don't spend a whole lot of money, come up with a whole plan, and then get rejected all the way down the line. I'd like them to know up front, no, we're not going to approve something like that. So that's what I'd like to have, some definition about what we feel is appropriate. Now, do we have to have a moratorium to do that? I don't know. The city attorney's saying no.
No, you certainly don't. I mean, everyone's in this area, and as you've all said, that is a remarkable area. Will it change in 10 years? Time would only tell. But you don't have to create the moratorium to go ahead and look at design guidelines or specific plan.
So that could be something that we submit to the Planning Commission
as priorities,
work on that.
Right.
Okay.
Knowing that, you know, staff's concern is there could be some projects in the next year in this area.
Mm-hmm. Well, as long as we have that conversation about what we're looking for, even if it's in works with the Planning Commission, anybody coming forward with a project would have an idea, at least, that this is where it's heading. So they'd run the risk of going against that.
And I would also say, if you looked at it at priorities time also, it probably would be something that you could use Harbor Fund money for, since it is in an area that would also relate to the waterfront leases.
Okay. All right. So, Bill, having heard all this discussion, what do you think?
Well, I think we need design guidelines. If we think we can do them without this, that's fine. So many other times when we've, and I'm not saying it's going to happen in this case, but so many other times when we've talked about things like this, you end up with a half a dozen projects running in the door down there in order to beat the clock. So, and as I say, there's no idea that that's going to happen in this case. I haven't heard anything, and I certainly would think we'd probably know about that. But it's up. Takes 4/5. It's up to the council. I'm not sitting here. I'm not in love with the idea that it's an urgency ordinance. Other than the fact, I'd like to get some design guidelines before we watch the thing change. If we can do it without, fine.
And can I jump in here too? That Bill. As soon as we say something like this, it's like the effect on the interest rates nationally and all that stuff. It starts to alert the area that was sleepy and watching the ocean and happy. And now we say moratorium, they'll go, whoa, design guidelines, wah, like that. So I would suggest that if we're going to do those design guidelines, now that we've let the cat out of the box, that we ought to do it quickly, very soon. Because that is absolutely a miracle area that I so appreciate having in this town.
Well, that's a good segue into the fact that we are going to have our priority setting meeting at the end of January, and we will have to give direction on things like this to staff as to what comes first and where in our own priorities. So it's
from the LCP, the guidelines for the area use B, I think you'll find that it's fairly restrictive, and so I don't think we're in a situation where even if something does come forward, that this alone would help us to put it in perspective. There's five criteria here for the PD overlay, and two of them relate to commercial development in that area, and the others relate to residential, and two relate to residential and one relates to the bay. And I think any one of those or a combination of those would be helpful. I won't read them because I know we all have the same handout. The other point is a suggestion that if indeed there's going to be some kind of review of this area, that the people from that area be allowed to be in some kind of committee or review of that, not in an after the fact, but in a preparation of that kind of a document. There are people that have lived there for 50 years. So Mrs. Brebs, I think, spoke to that tonight, as well as, Ms. Cutter, who's lived there for 45 years. And, it's a very old, stabilized neighborhood. And I think that those kinds of people, Mrs. Redmond, should be involved in this process.
I agree. All right, so I'm getting the idea nobody's going to bring forward a motion for a moratorium. Do you want to try it?
No, I think we're fine. I don't see 4/5 there. I'm not going to push it.
Okay. All right, so we'll pursue the area when we get to design guidelines and public hearings with the Planning Commission and have all of you who live out there involved in that and get your input. Thank you for saying
this. And Ms. Mayor, when we meet with the Planning Commission, I think one of the topics of discussion could be, we're very concerned about this area. We're treating it with kid gloves. Why aren't we doing that in other sections of town? So I think that that's a topic that we could put on our agenda.
Absolutely, yeah. Okay, and then we move on to D2. Which is the cable television agreement terms and a summary of the Digital Infrastructure and Video Competition Act of 2006.
Madam Mayor, members of the council, I believe the council requested a report on this, and the context of the discussion at the time was city response to service issues of various kinds. And so what we tried to do is approach this from two angles. One was to talk about what the city's existing responsibilities and authority are under our current franchise agreement, which runs through 2013. So we've got a lot of time to think about where we might be headed here. But there are a couple of scenarios that could change that, and they're outlined in the report. So rather than belabor the various issues in the law, what I would like to do is just simply ask what kinds of service issues there are, if any, and how we might best approach them, and what maybe the concerns of the council were about charter service, and we'll attempt to proceed on that. But the tools at our disposal are basically the same tools that we've had in the past, and will be for at least the foreseeable future, it looks like.
Okay, Bill, I think you
I brought this one forward,
yeah.
too. Okay. I know many of you receive calls from citizens regarding certain things, and some of us seem to get calls from regarding different issues. My issue that I've received the most calls on has been what I would say kindly deteriorating customer service from a certain cable company. I checked with Janine, and she says that she's receiving an increased number of complaints about how people are being treated, maltreated, mistreated, if you will, by Charter Cable. They've, I guess, gone to some, I don't even know if it's in Bangladesh, but when you call customer service, nobody seems to know where your call ends up, and that doesn't matter because the people you talk to have no clue what you're talking about anyway. And, you know, I brought this forward because I'd really love to have somebody from Charter come along and tell us what the percentage increase in our city is of people who are not satisfied, who are not getting the treatment that we feel they should be from this cable company. There are a number of things, you know, we can do in here that have been outlined, and I just think we ought to just ask Charter to show up and say, okay, you're making a money on this thing, how come you're not providing the service, and what, how many complaints have you received, and what percentage of them have you resolved, if any? And it's not just limited to channels. I've had complaints from people regarding having had their internet service discontinued for no good reason, and it takes several days for somebody to figure out why. And I mean, it's something you could go to a computer and about half a dozen keystrokes it could be restored, but that seems to be beyond some of the people's comprehension that are dealing with this stuff now.
Complaints about this, I would love to see us do at least the minimum that staff says we can do here in terms of compliance review. And the topics that they've chosen, and I've circled several that I think are directly related to the issues that Mr. Pierce brought up, and would very much like to see us move ahead.
Okay, Melody?
See, this has been through PWEB. I absolutely agree with you about that 800 number. I called them the other day, and I've been telling people that you can actually sign up for a $21 service with Charter, but first you have to go through the hellish answering machine thing, and the people who live somewhere else. What I was curious about, a couple of things. I think that staff is asking about when to review, how thorough to do this review, and I think that there's no point in really reviewing this until 2987 is in force, and I'm just wondering, does that come into force in January? So that's pretty soon. Charter has to apply by April 1st of 07, and no later than January of the following year to become a state franchise. So, and I guess it can become a state franchise in a number of ways. So I think when it comes into force and when Charter decides how it will become a state franchise is when we would want to thoroughly look at the agreement.
I'll correct you a little bit in that,
okay.
Since we have an existing agreement, the only way they can apply for the state franchise is if we agree and let them do that. So
still
have to comply with their current agreement until that expires, which is
2013.
And the other way is if someone else comes into the city who has a state franchise. I find that highly unlikely.
Absolutely.
So I really think, and they have not come forward and say they want to get a state franchise, and we'd have to bring that forward. My initial reaction would be, no, we've got an agreement, we want that to play out, because I'm assuming any state franchise is going to give us less control, not more control.
And
so we do have till 2013 with them.
Okay, so AB 2987 doesn't cause them to cut out on that agreement with the city to become a state franchise?
Well, I would just offer one caution, and that is that 2987 is passed. the assignment has been given to the PUC, but we don't know what they're going to do to carry that out. They're going to develop regulations and propose them. It's a sort of a self-policing mm-hmm. approach.
How nice.
But they would present us with the report, and we could say whether we believe it or not.
Yes.
Rick, do you... I'm sorry, Betty.
No, I'm done. Excuse me.
Bob, just a question. They're a state franchise holder with more than a million customers in California?
The way the system, the current system, the pre-2987 system was, they would have a file cabinet full of individual franchises with various local entities, the county, maybe each of the cities in our county, and in more urban areas, you would have more larger groups of people within a single franchise, but the same basic idea. And what 2987 is doing is the concept is to move that responsibility from the local entities to the state and have them carried out by the Public Utilities Commission, so that when these franchise agreements are drafted, that they're uniform statewide, that there's uniform language in them and standards and so on. That's the cable industry's complaint about the current system, is that local entities have put features in their own agreements that are unique, and so they're hard to... Paso Robles does it one way, and Morro Bay does it another way, and they have to deal with all these differences and strange language and different standards and so on across the state. But with the PUC in charge, there would be sort of a model for delivery of service and the standards and how they would be carried out and how they'd be policed and who'd report to who and on what basis. So they'd have just one set of rules to play with all across the state.
Madam Mayor.
So, and I think the good way to look at a scenario right now is Charter does not have an agreement with Solvang right now. So since they don't have an agreement, it expired, they will go up to state and get a state franchise agreement with the state and have that in effect. When ours expires, they would do the same thing in 2013. So at one point in time, Charter will have a state franchise agreement, which all the same terms and conditions for all the different cities. So as they expire, they'll ask for one for that area, and keep going until there are no more individual city agreements.
Under the discrimination clause on page 6 of 9, are they held to the fire then as far as Morro Bay residents?
When it expires and they go to the state for the state franchise, who gets the franchise fees? The PUC?
No, we'll get our 5% is I think the amount that's been, yeah, the state franchise fee of 5% annual gross revenues is established as a rent, which will then come back.
So we would still get the money even though we have no say over how they do it. And the other question, based on what you mentioned about Solvang, does Solvang have a choice as to whether or not they come in? They're just there. We're your cable company. Stuff it. Okay.
And that would be the same with us now, as if Comcast or someone else says they want to come to Morro Bay.
The alternate side of that is from the argument that the cable companies would use is that cable company X could go to the PUC and argue that they want to provide service within the city of Solvang, and PUC could grant them a franchise agreement as well, or instead of the one for Charter. I know there's a lot of economic barriers there, but that's the theory.
Okay, so it looks like where we're going is that we would like to have a review. And Betty, you said you had some, what? I think Bill does too. Which items would we like to have? We can request that they do this review, right? That's part of the agreement
now. Do I just do all of them that they mentioned?
Correct, Rob? Okay.
So I think the ones that are most appropriate to us that I've circled, and certainly I'm open to anybody else's suggestion, the first three on that page, the bottom two on that page, and the bottom two on the next page.
And I would add 1, 2, 3, 4, the fifth one in the middle of the first page.
Well, let's just...
We could leave it, maybe say, focus the motion so that staff knows what our intent is, and that if they need to add things to it as well.
I would concur with Betty's choice of the one in the middle of the page, too.
I would say, why don't we just have them review all of the items? Okay. Because I don't know how long it's been since we've had a review. I don't remember. When did we last request one?
I don't think we ever have.
So I think it's certainly reasonable.
I don't remember under the current agreement.
Okay.
Which was 2004?
So I think it's certainly reasonable to just ask that they review everything.
Well, the limit that's on this page.
Yeah, all of these items.
Which is, okay. Would you like a motion?
Sure.
I would move that council direct staff to communicate with cable that we would like a limited scope.
Okay.
Here it comes.
D3, review of mobile rent control ordinance regarding conversion and residency requirements. And this is Rob.
Again, I'll start us off, but and then I'll pass it off to Councilmember Winholtz, who's had this item as a future agenda item. I'll start off by just the background of mobile home parks provide a significant pool of affordable housing here in the city of Morro Bay. We currently have 18 mobile home parks, which provide 350 mobile home spaces. Almost all of those are mobile homes that are purchased and owned by the tenant. They own the coach, but they don't own the underlying land. That is owned by the owner of the property. And I don't have a breakdown of that 350 as to which ones fall underneath our mobile home rent control ordinance that we redid, I think we're going on 2 years or a year and a half ago. So it provides a very affordable housing, and I'm sure that's the concern of Council Member Winholtz, making sure that we preserve that affordable housing. That being said, you know, a mobile home park conversion ordinance can almost be as contentious as a view protection ordinance. And it's very difficult to find out that balance between a property right and also the tenants preserving that affordable housing unit. I've provided you a little bit different. The county has been going through this now for about a year and a half. And they came out with a report to send it to the Board of Supervisors to create a moratorium and to create a task force to look into the issues of these conversions and whether there's an issue, a problem there. We currently don't have anyone that's requesting a conversion. We currently don't have anyone even kicking the tires. I asked planners if anybody's come in about converting mobile home parks, and we don't have anybody there. But that doesn't mean it can't happen tomorrow. But I do think we're a little different than county in that because we're in the coastal jurisdiction, we've got the Coastal Act. And certainly in the county, there are certain areas that are in the Coastal Act. But under the Coastal Act, in which we had to incorporate into our zoning ordinance, we have some restrictions in that if you take away the affordable housing or senior housing, you have to provide a one-to-one ratio of a replacement. And that certainly, to me, is a huge disincentive. I am the most familiar with is probably Blue Heron, which is 73 mobile homes, I believe, are out. They tried to do a couple of things more restrictive than even the state law, a longer period of time giving notice to the tenant, providing more fair compensation to the tenant than is allowed under state law. And I talk about the impact report that has to be done. They try to tighten up the guidelines for having to do an impact report for the closure. So that being said, I guess, you know, from my standpoint, without seeing any out there, you know, don't know if we want to open another can of worms, as was said earlier. It's something we certainly should be looking at, though, and have there. It's just where does it fall in the priorities? I'd kind of like to see where Huntington Beach comes out on that litigation. Goleta does have, though, a conversion ordinance that has withstood the test. So we could look at that if that's something you want to look at further. And also see where the county heads with it went through their process and what suggestions they have up. But I'll leave it up to you, Councilmember Winholtz, to take over and with her ideas, and I'm available for any questions.
Okay, Betty? I actually see a loophole in a couple of these government codes, and Rob will have to correct me if I'm misusing them, but when Rockview was bought a few years ago, it was publicly announced, our intent is for you to go away, and we're going to do something different with the park. So that was, I think, my initial concern. And I think that 5 years is almost halfway there. And so with the little, and I know a couple of our mobile home parks are owned by people who are aging, and who knows what may happen to them in any time. So it's not an emergency, but I think it's something we need to be aware of. And I don't know if Rockview still intends to do that or not.
I don't know if they do, but I think what your concern is, and when I get calls about conversions, one of the suggestions I say for them to do is find out how many of the spaces are owned by the owner. The one in Cambria that closed, what they do is systematically when a space comes available, they buy that space back. And if you get to the point where you own all or most of those spaces, then you do have the ability under state law, for example, then you'd only be replacing maybe three affordable housing spaces because you've bought up the other one. Now, remember, while you buy those up, they don't become affordable, or right. They're still affordable, not the same, because they don't fall under our rent control when they're owner-owned. So that's...
I see two strategies that it's happening. One's the Rockview, where they just publicly come out and say, this is what my intent is, and so people immediately start selling their places. Now, that one wasn't necessarily full-time. It was more of an RV rather than a mobile home. But then there's the Silver City incident that's going on right now, where exactly what Mr. Schultz is describing is going on, where the owner is pressuring people out, and he's buying up their places. And so I do see this as something that we need to, if we're going to be proactive about it and not get reactive about it, that we need to address because of these loopholes. Galita, I must have handed out all my copies, but I gave you a copy. There's just a couple of pages there, and it only relates to the bottom of the first page. It has a picture on it. It looks like that. And the top of the second page. And theirs is a very benign type of item. It doesn't really address conversions directly, but rather it describes what the city's intent is in terms of maintaining these and maybe the need to take care of the zoning where these parks are. Now, I did go to the phone book just as a curiosity and found that only six of our 16 or 18 parks are actually advertised as mobile homes. Another six are advertised as RV parks. And then there are some that are in between. And so we have, and I think this is something that Mr. Hamp pointed out in his letter to us, that we have a complexity of parks here, and that would need to be addressed. I think where I would like to see this go, and this maybe can be thrown out for the discussion, is that maybe a subcommittee be formed of two people from council, two people from planning commission, and maybe, and I don't know whether those four people can then decide what to do, if they want to interview park owners, park renters, whatever, but that this needs to begin to be addressed. And that rather than let it get lost or do something scary and immediate, that it become kind of a study session.
Okay.
I'll just jump in a little bit.
Yes.
Because the one in Goleta is a little different because it's a general plan, and I didn't review our policies. I did it from a zoning more issue because the zoning is much more detailed, exactly what you have to prepare in order if you were going to close it in the steps. And that's something if you did go with a task force or whatever you'd look at. I believe if you looked at our housing element or our general plan, you're going to find a lot of these policies that might be a lot like that, making sure that you keep looked at more just a zoning issue from the other cities in Huntington Beach and the other ones as to how they did it from a zoning when the applicant actually comes in and says, I want to close my park. How would I go about doing that?
Okay, Melody?
Really? If someone wants to come in and said they want to do that, we would point them right off the bat to the one-to-one replacement.
Right.
But other ones actually have the permit process you have to go through in the zoning, and you point it to them. This is the procedure you have to go through.
Well, I know I talked with a developer about one of the small mobile home parks, and I think it only has 17 units. And he said there's no way I can afford to do that, even though I'd like to. I can't. You know, make it pencil out to put 17 affordable units where those mobile homes are. So, Melody.
Well, when you talk about zoning, and when we all talk about zoning, we have this old blue book that I'm carrying around, 1988 zoning. And then we have this other thing in process that I hear is back from the Coastal Commission, but I don't know when we're going to see it. So which zoning are you talking about, number one? And number two, I mean, I could use some time probably to look through all these documents, but and you're not the guy to ask.
No.
The people we're missing.
Correct. But
are those safeguards about mobile homes that are in zoning right now still there in the new zoning?
Yes.
And it, you know, and then I'm wondering about the 200 comments from Coastal. What did they say? And I'm sure they were fine with
correct.
The affordable housing.
Whenever I talk about any time, and I think I said that in the email, was that we should only be dealing with our current zoning. Although you've approved an updated LCP, you've approved an updated zoning, until we get those back and finally adopted, we should work only with our current regulations. And our current regulations require the one-to-one replacement, and you carried that on. The interesting thing, when the Area B came up on our previous moratorium, I went to look to make sure we had preserved those in our LCP that was going up to that, and we had. It's not, we don't, it's more difficult to find, and it's not really an Area B, but it's in there the exact same language and describes the area. So, and the one-to-one I checked to see if it was carried over, but when I at least when I use it, and I think zoning, when we talk, we talk about the current, because we have no idea when that's going to be approved and what changes will be made by Coastal.
And then you were talking about this thing that Betty handed us, if we could look at the second page of it, and I think it's the bottom pop that zoning ordinance is coming back in 5 years.
One would hope.
You know. So I think we need to consider really what we have in play in the new zoning as well as what's in there now, and is it strong enough? Or do we rely on California Code and Mellow Act and those kinds of things to assure that? The other question too is how do we check if somebody wants to close a park down, where those people go? When we displace low income or moderate income people with any kind of a project, how do we track where they go and that they are placed well in other arrangements? I mean,
you're kind of talking about two different situations. If it was just under our zoning, which is the one-to-one replacement,
right,
we really wouldn't be concerned. Our concern isn't about that person, that you, just that you're preserving the affordable housing for someone. Now, that's that scenario. Let's say if it was apartments being converted into single-family residence. In that situation, you'd have to do the one-to-one ratio, but we wouldn't track. That's a little bit different, though, in a mobile home situation where they have interstate, where you have to provide compensation. The question is a lot of cities think the compensation provided in finding replacement isn't adequate and are trying to give more stringent requirements. But you do track at that. I think state probably would be the agency that tracks that, and to a certain extent we would also through the impact report.
And they'd probably have to provide us the new addresses or locations. Yeah. Where did these people all go? Yeah.
Rick?
You know, it certainly is real important on affordable housing, and I think that the relationship that we've always had between the tenants and the landlords at the mobile home parks have worked well for a long time, and I'm happy there's no owner-initiated conversion pending right now. The government code sections that apply to the park conversions, is there language that separates the RV park and mobile home parks, or do they both fall under those? On page 2.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I'm going to say off the top of my head, it depends on the length of the stay then that they become under the mobile home.
The length of the stay?
Yeah, the length mm-hmm. of the stay.
I think it's something that I would hate to see happen to the low-income residents in the city that live in them, but I also at this point feel that it's not the time for us to start moving forward at this as far as a moratorium of any kind. I think we should be aware of it. I think that we should also maybe at some point in the not-too-distant future look at what the potentials are and what the problems are, but I don't want to take any action now on that.
Mr. Pierce,
the action that I'm suggesting is just a study group. And I think that it's going to take a long time to study this. And that if we start that now, there may be, you know, a report in 6 to 12 months. And with Silver City transitioning as it is, and Rockview doing something different in a couple of years, because that, I think, was done about 3 years ago, I would like, or unless you object to just a study group.
No,
I would,
I don't.
Okay. Then I would hope that the council would agree to having two of us meet with two planners and planning commissioners, and that we could start that process.
I think you'd also have to include some folks from the mobile home park owners.
I think that's
in there too.
A great idea then.
So you're looking at an ad hoc committee, basically.
Right.
Well, I wasn't wanting to do something as full blown as New Futures or the View Shed. I was trying to keep it fairly simple and
a limited
slow moving.
Frame.
I'm interested in very slow moving.
We can do that.
Well, I'd like to support Betty on that and make sure that everyone understands that this is about looking at the need for an ordinance, not a moratorium at all.
Right.
And that I think when you find out that we have 18 parks, I've always been just amazed that we have 18 parks in this town, 350 spaces. And then I will believe you on this one, Rob, economic pressure. You used that in two staff reports. This one, I believe it. I mean, these are some flat lands, nice spaces, nice areas. And yes, there is government code that gives them some protection, but that doesn't mean that somebody with $1 million isn't going to come in someday and say, well, I'll just put them over here in these condos or apartments, and then I'll grade this and put up some big structures. So I would appreciate having a study group formed.
Well, I could agree with that, too. I think it is something that does have to be looked at. Mr. Hemp, I think, sent us all an email that raises some really good points on the problems.
And two people from the Planning Commission and others from the community as those four people deem helpful.
I would say mobile home park.
Mobile home park.
Residents or owners.
Residents or owners, then.
I would think.
Okay. And that... its only mission is to study this and report back to the council in 9 months.
Okay. Do I hear a second?
I'd second it.
Okay. I think she got it in first. Melody, second. Any discussion? Well, I suppose we should talk about who the second council person is going to be. I'm assuming you're going to be one.
It's not necessary.
Anybody like to volunteer to be the second one? Rick, you're brand new. You haven't got any assignments yet. You want to go for it?
Pretty smart, huh? I'm up to work right
now. Okay. All right. All in favor? Okay, so we have Betty and Rick are the two that we're talking about. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? None.
Madam Mayor, how would we go about getting two people from the commission?
Well, I'd say we ought to wait until we get our new planning commission assigned, which we'll be doing in January. Yeah. Right. And then we'll go with that. Is that okay? Okay. And we can have that at our joint meeting. That could be another one of the topics, you know, who'd like to serve on it.
Okay.
D4, discussion for policy for cancellation of advisory board meetings. Rob. Well, we're keeping you busy tonight, aren't we?
Yes, you are. this came at the request, I think, of I'm not sure which individual council members, but it was all of you, about a PWEB meeting that had been canceled. So I pulled out our policy on that. Our advisory handbook and bylaws require them to comply with the city council policies and procedures, which is the exact same. You did do a couple amendments, actually, to your this policy about a month and a half, 2 months ago, I think it was, about our own meetings. I've passed this on to all the staff and made sure that they need to comply with this. If it's going to be canceled, it has to be done by a majority or an emergency, which technically the one that was PWEB was canceled was emergency, at least that's the way staff felt it was. So I'm not sure if you want to do anything else on that issue other than making sure that we follow it, or do you need more amend any definition of an emergency?
You do excuse me, you do have the practical problem though of you could have the set of circumstances where you just didn't have a quorum for whatever set of reasons, you know. In that case, the meeting would not occur. So,
sure.
Yeah, aside from any decision to go or not go.
Mm-hmm. Can I jump in here just a little bit? As a former member of PWEB, and I know that many of you were former members of one of the commissions, that especially on PWEB, and I've heard that they've had some of these cancellations, that Bill comes in and gives this director's report that is simply an update on about 12 different issues. I just think it's deadly to citizen input and citizen investment in the town to be canceling meetings unless it is the citizens themselves that say, I'm sick, I'm out of town, and you can't get a quorum. But I think for a staff member, I think we ought to try to either send the first or the second or the third in charge, and I think we're losing the third a lot, but the first or the second person, a guy who can go in and give a director's report. And if the meeting's up and down in half an hour, we've had those. I still have it so that it appears on AGP video. People see that we always gather our PWEB or our Rec and Parks people together. And I think the only reason for canceling, really, should be that we can't get a quorum out of them and that we make that clear to them that that's why it happened, not that staff directed it, but that the citizens themselves didn't or couldn't show up.
And I reflected that being also your, when we changed the policy, that kind of being what you had said about your own meetings. And so I have already passed that on, that you need to have your meetings even if there isn't anything per se that you want to bring forward, that council has said you need to have the meeting. So I pass that on, but I can do it again if that's council's desire. You know, make sure that they are holding their meetings regardless of the fact of whether there is an agenda item that they need to bring forward. They can bring forward, like you said, the director's report.
Bill, comments?
No, I think it's covered.
Rick? Okay. So do we need to have a motion on this at all? No.
No.
Okay. All right.
I think we've all agreed that there needs to be meetings. Hey, it's government, right?
Okay. Setting dates for commission and advisory board interviews. Bridget.
Specifics we need definitely to put out there, but we'll try and include that in our advertising.
Good point. And have we determined 5 people on that one as well? I think we did. Yeah, Rob's nodding. Yes.
Madam Mayor, as far as the date for the interviews, it really couldn't be before about the 24th, 25th, or 26th, could it? I mean, considering the advertising and deadline dates and so forth.
All right. We've got a JPA meeting on the 25th. We've got our fifth Monday on the 29th. So that's our priorities meeting.
Do we have city council on the 22nd? Are you saying that?
I believe so.
Mayor?
Yes.
I could suggest that you move it up 1 week, the week of the 15th.
Okay.
And then I will place the deadline as of the 12th.
Okay. Do we have to define what that Measure Q committee is going to be for the advertisement?
We'll get busy on that. I don't remember the specifics of what we put in there. We'll go back and make sure that the advertising
They need to know how often they're going to have to meet, things like that.
We'll go back and find out what we actually said in the measure, make sure the ads are consistent with that. And there may be something you need to decide along the way, and if there is,
Meeting in January.
Bring that back to you. Yeah.
Okay. We'll follow the ordinance language is what we would follow as to the number of people. I think we agreed to biannually. We changed that little piece on it. And the advertising will explain what the ordinance entails.
Okay. All right.
Can I ask you, Bridget was just talking about, I'm sorry, but
the week of the 15th.
Yeah, the January 12th deadline. And our first advertisement will be January 3rd and then January 10th.
That's also very flexible.
Thank you. Well, I just have a little concern about it having it come into, like, between Christmas and New Year's when people are traveling and not really looking at the paper. But, yeah, I like the January 3rd date and the January 10th date. And I don't know what if that's good enough. That they see it on January 10th with a deadline of the 12th, like 2 days later.
The only issue with that is notifying people by mail, but I can always give them a phone call. It just cuts it real tight.
What if we did the interviews on the 31st after the fact?
Well, that could work. We don't have another meeting until the 12th.
When does the Planning Commission meet? So that would miss both of their meetings in January. But I think we were going to miss both their meetings in January anyway. Yeah, the other scheme.
Yeah, by the time we get them appointed, yeah.
Right.
But if they're appointed by the 31st,
yeah.
It says that there, doesn't this say that everybody, the vacancies aren't effective until?
Yeah.
So that's okay.
But Betty, if we're going to do it on the 31st.
You're saying the planning persons will be crowded to get there?
Yeah, that's going to be awful tight if they have a meeting on the 5th, unless they don't have a meeting.
We can do speed training.
Move the JPA meeting.
I guess my question I had for Bob is, I mean, we have it scheduled that day, but we don't know if there's going to be a meeting for sure because we kind of wait and see if we've got something from our consultant or from, you know, staff. And certainly if you schedule on that day, then we won't have a JPA.
About the 24th and 25th, then we'll just assume that the JPA meeting is sort of like...
Yeah, but then if there is one, we're stuck.
Okay. Well, we say we
what we can do relative to the JPA meeting is if you schedule these for these nights, then we'll let them know right away that those nights wouldn't be available for the JPA meeting. We'll work on scheduling it around.
Maybe put that the next week or something. Okay. All right, so you want to go for the 24th and the 25th for the interviews?
And why are we doing it in two nights and one instead of one night?
How many we got? Two, three.
Are we going to try to do Measure Q that night? The Citizens Oversight. See.
Well, that one was not. That's not immediate. I mean, that's not.
But we're advertising for it.
Well, and we can do that, but that could be its own special night. Then, or is that what you're saying? I don't see that it's going to take two nights to do these four commissions.
Well, it's 14 people, and we do them together now, which happens a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Quicker.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, well, let's go for one night then. Why don't we go for Wednesday and then
see what
maybe
happens.
Or maybe not there'll be a Thursday JP.
Okay, and the schedule that I've chosen for advertising is okay.
Looks good.
I think it's great.
Okay.
That's in your staff report on the 3rd, the 10th, with the deadline
of the 19th.
So, all those folks out there who are thinking about volunteering their time to the city on one of our boards or commissions should pay attention to the paper.
Well, and actually, if they're watching right now, here's what we have. Two vacancies on the Planning Commission, one vacancy on Public Works Advisory Board, three vacancies on the Harbor Advisory Board, three vacancies on Community Promotions, and five vacancies on the Measure Q Advisory Board. So if any of you out there are interested in those, please let Bridget know and she'll get you an application. All right, and we'll move on. Item D6, appointment of vice mayor to serve a one-year term. Do I hear nominations or shall I make one?
What did you just say? I'm sorry. Are you looking for nominations?
I would nominate Melody.
I'll second it.
Any of the other nominations? Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? None.
Thank you.
I don't think we've had a split vote all night.
No, we haven't.
I don't remember when that last happened.
What's wrong with us?
It's the holiday spirit.
Or Mr. Grantham's brought us good luck.
Okay, so we'll conclude with this quote from Adela Rogers St. John. I love her. Thought for today is, happiness is a sort of atmosphere you can live in sometimes when you're lucky. Joy is a light that fills you with hope and faith and love. Merry Christmas, everyone. Happy holidays. We'll see you next year.